baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go, riding along in my automobile. I was anxious to tell her the
You're listening
way
to the Flushing Exceptionalism podcast, right in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. My name is Jefferson. I run the website, and this episode, my special guest is Mr. Jack Eichenbaum, who is the official Queensborough historian.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on to the show. I think it's a pretty good way to spend a day holed up because of the weather anyway, right?
Sure is.
Okay. Jack, can you talk a bit about your personal history and I guess a little bit about the post of borough historian?
I was born here in Flushing Hospital. Almost 70 years ago. I'll be 70 next February. My parents were living in Bayside at the time, so I actually grew up in Bayside, but my father was working here in Flushing from 1941 until 1971. He actually worked at a fruit and vegetable produce market that was between what is now Macy's and what is now the Duane Reade at the corner. Then it was a Gertz department store and a on the corner was a Woolworths. Mm-hmm. So there have been a lot of changes, of course, in the businesses in Flushing. My father worked there as a retail clerk, and so he dealt with all the kinds of people that would shop there. And he began to notice all the changes that were taking place in Flushing in the 50s and 60s, not to mention the 70s, when the Asian community was really beginning. So growing up here, of course, I've got a lot of personal history. But I left New York when I was 20, and I had a degree in engineering from Cooper Union. I was a bachelor of chemical engineering, and I really didn't know much about history other than my own. Mm-hmm. But I wound up in my travels, and in both intellectually and on this planet, with a PhD in urban geography from the University of Michigan in 1972. And I spent some time in Seattle and Israel and Europe and whatever. And I came back to Flushing in 1976. When I was born, New York City was the greatest city in the world. When I came back to New York in 1976, it was really in bad shape. The year before is the famous headline, Ford, who was president then, to New York dropped dead when Ford wouldn't rescue New York from its financial crisis. And the next year, 1977, was the year that probably one of the most famous advertising campaigns began, and that's the I Love New York campaign, which began to turn the city around. So I came back at that crucial time when things were really at the bottom, and Flushing Main Street was emptied out, basically, of all the classy stores. People were shopping. The people who were still middle class and had cars were going to suburban shopping malls for the most part. There really wasn't that much to shop for in Flushing. And already, unbeknownst to me at the time, Asian immigrants were buying property in Flushing, particularly on the side streets, at prices that were really very, very low. Now, of course, prices in Flushing real estate are very, very high. When I came back as an urban geographer, and I started looking at my surroundings through those lenses, which are very different. You know, I'm trained to look at cities, and I now apply that training to not just New York, but with my own community, and all an awful lot of things that happened in Flushing historically that I knew something about because I lived through them now make certain sense on a certain conceptual level that I wouldn't have recognized growing up here at all. Back starting in 1980, one of the things I did to support myself was I started doing a tour business. I led walking tours in the city, particularly for college classes that were not necessarily in New York, that would come from outside of New York, using New York to understand cities. And I would take them, I would understand what they were doing conceptually. In New York, you can find a neighborhood that illustrates whatever you want. You can understand this theory or this problem or that problem, because there's so much going on here in this very complex city. And so when the last historian kind of left his position because he had dementia, they put the position open again. It is an unpaid position. It's mostly honorary. In other, every county in New York State has an appointed historian, but it's a person who will be contacted by groups who are asking certain research questions, someone to be a face on the borough. And I was well known. I'm not really trained as a historian. There are others who are trained better than I, but I had a face in the borough because I led all these walking tours and I was active in some community organizations. And, you know, it's a position which combines a sense of history as well as personal history. So I am the Queensborough historian, and I field a lot of questions from people about Queens. I know some of the people. Even if I don't know the answer, and I don't know the answer about something about Queens' history, I know who to tell them to go to.
Okay. So can you take us back to the very beginning of Flushing as a community? Because, I mean, it's something that I think most people living here in the neighborhood are completely in the dark about.
Okay. Flushing's European history, the European settlement of Flushing, begins with the Dutch. The Dutch colonized this part of North America, the Hudson River Valley, and they called that area, which actually stretched from the Delaware River to the Housatonic River, which runs through Connecticut and empties into the Long Island Sound at Bridgeport. And that whole area was called New Netherlands. And New Netherlands was different because it was a commercial colony rather than a religious colony. Anyway, the Dutch colony begins in 1624. You have an outpost at Albany, but the more important place is the trading post at the tip of Manhattan Island called New Amsterdam. One of the problems in Manhattan is the fact that much of what underlies the surface of Manhattan is rock. And you can see that in Central Park when you walk through Central Park. You see these rocks coming up. And Manhattan is not hospitable for farming because of all this rock. The Dutch started exploring the tidal creeks that lead into Long Island and Staten Island. One of those tidal creeks is what we call Flushing Creek. And Flushing Creek, you can see when you take the number 7 train from Manhattan into Flushing, and just before you go into the tunnel that takes you under Main Street in Flushing, you cross a body of water that we call Flushing Creek. And the original colonists would find themselves on Flushing Creek, and they could come out into Flushing and walk from that creek and go up on a plateau. The first plateau is College Point Boulevard, and then College Point Boulevard and Prince Street and Main Street are one plateau that's about 30 feet above sea level. And then you start going up towards Union Street and Bound Street, and you find yourself going up another 30 or 40 feet. And by the time you get to Bound Street, where we're sitting here now, you're about 70 feet above sea level. So that was high and dry land, and it was good for farming for two reasons. Number one, it wouldn't be flooded.
like right now.
Right? Like right now. And if you look at the flood maps now, you'll see that anything near Flushing Creek was places where they'd have to evacuate people.
Right.
But here we're high and dry. We don't really have a problem. So this was good farming land because it's away from the creek, but still not far from the creek, so you can get there. High and dry farmland, relatively good soils, and away from the Indians who would be on the creek. So the Indians didn't really live around here, but they got around by canoes or whatever, so you could see the Indians coming. Other tidal creeks that were also explored, like Newtown Creek, which separates Brooklyn from Queens, Westchester Creek, which goes into the Bronx, and Gowanus Canal, which was originally Gowanus Creek, none of them have these advantages that Flushing Creek had. So Flushing was the superior agricultural settlement. And when it was the original patent for Flushing, for the township of Flushing, which was granted by the Dutch West India Company in 1645, also said something else that was very important, that was kind of what was happening in the Dutch colony. This is probably the most liberal colony in the New World. The other colonies that the English had set up were kind of mono-religious or mono-theological, mostly settled by church groups that couldn't really practice in England. So they got here and they pretty much formed their own little church colony, and other people were really not very eager to become part of that. In the New Netherlands, and particularly in New Amsterdam, they were more interested in business, and they had already let in blacks, some of whom were slaves, some of whom were they let in Jews, they let in some Catholics. And so this was a busy place where a number of languages were spoken. And the first settlers in Flushing from Europe were mostly people from England who were trying to find a place that would be liberal for them, to respect their Protestant religion. And they found that the New Netherlands colony would give them this land here in Flushing, and a treaty was made with the Indians. So by 1645, Flushing had a group of several hundred colonists from England who spoke English for the most part. A very important event here happened in 1657. This is 12 years later. One group that was seeking to establish itself in the New World was the Quakers. And the Quakers was the Quaker religion was a very radical religion for England and for Europe. First, the Quakers tried to establish themselves in Holland, but they really weren't accepted there. And they tried to come to the New World. They tried to come into New England. They really didn't find a place there. Then they tried to come to Flushing. Peter Stuyvesant, who was the governor of all of New Netherlands and sitting in his Stadthuis in New Amsterdam, was afraid of the Quakers. A lot of people were afraid of the Quakers because they were kind of weird. Number one, they didn't really have a leader. They didn't have a priest. And all they had were meeting houses. They called each other friends instead of fellow congregants. They didn't believe in war. They wouldn't fight for you. So there were a lot of things about the Quakers which were very unusual. And maybe you really didn't want to grant these people a broad welcome. So Stuyvesant issued an edict that saying not only are Quakers can settle here, but they can't establish their religion. And anybody helps them establish their religion will be put in jail.
Were they the only religion that was unwelcome, basically, in New Amsterdam?
No.
Okay.
The Jews didn't have it so easy, and okay. the Huguenots, who were French Protestants, didn't have it that easy, but eventually they got in. In any event, the Quakers set a target in Flushing, even though Stuyvesant had issued this edict. And even before the Quakers got here, Flushing stood up, and the mostly English-speaking inhabitants of Flushing issued a document called the Flushing Remonstrance, which was a formal answer to Stuyvesant's edict that says, we believe that anybody should be able to settle here. And the document even mentions Jews and Hindus and doesn't get into the Far Eastern religions, but does talk about religions around the world. And we believe that that this place should recognize freedom of religion, what they call freedom of conscience. And they stood up to Stuyvesant saying that they would support effectively the Quakers because they wouldn't be told what to do. And the Quakers did indeed come here. And there was a fellow named John Bowne, who was not one of the signers of the Flushing Remonstrance. This is now in 1659, a couple of years later, who helps the Quakers by allowing them to worship on his land, which is right across the street here on Bowne Street, right in the back of the Bowne House, which is one of the oldest buildings in the whole city, and it's 1661. And that's before the house was built. The Dutch authorities, Stuyvesant's people, found out about this, and they put Bowne in jail. And they sent him back to Holland for trial. And they found out in Holland that he was innocent. Bowne was innocent, and they sent him back, and the Quakers started worshiping in Flushing, and they worshiped on John Bowne's property. John Bowne eventually married a Quaker, which is why I think he allowed them to worship there in the first place.
Uh-huh.
And then in 1694, they built their own meeting house, which is now on Northern Boulevard, which is the oldest house of worship in New York State. And the Quakers still worship there, and they've been worshiping there continually, except during the American Revolution when the British seized it and was used as a hospital. But otherwise, the Quakers have been worshiping at that same place. So this is really the first Quaker community in the New World, even though Philadelphia is much more famous. So that's the early history of Flushing. And so Flushing starts out, it's probably the most important thing that ever happened in Flushing. It's one of the more important things for just human rights in general, and it led to our First Amendment, which is freedom of religion.
Mm-hmm. So, what other landmarks or symbols are still apparent today from that time period, besides, say, the Quaker meeting house?
Well, the only two things from the 17th century and from the Dutch period, from the 17th century at all, the Dutch colony of New Netherlands reverts to Britain in 1664 and becomes New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then that colony actually included New Jersey and parts of Connecticut, but the British separated it for political reasons into New York and New Jersey and gave parts of it to Connecticut, and they administered it that way. So the Quaker Meeting House in 1694 is already built when the British are here. The only thing surviving from the Dutch period is the Bound House. Mm-hmm. Something that happens, it's not under the Dutch again, it's under the British in the 1730s. Remember, Flushing's got good agricultural land. The very first nurseries in North America were begun here. And that's...
The first tree nurseries, right?
The first plant nurseries,
Plant nurseries, right.
And those were begun by William Prince. And Prince Street, which is one block west of Main Street, is named for him and his sons, who kept that nursery going for at least 100 years. And so that's the beginning of the nursery business, and Flushing's real first industry beyond farming, because horticulture is a little bit more organized than general farming. Uh-huh. And they grew a number of varieties of fruit trees and seed plants that were sold throughout the early Americas. This is before the United States, and Thomas Jefferson bought some things here. George Washington, when he was inaugurated as president and was in New York, visited the Prince Nursery, so they have a role to play in early horticulture and disseminating plants that were hybridized from Europe to withstand what is a slightly harsher climate mm-hmm. than the European climates. Later on came other nurserymen, the Murray Nurseries, and that's a Murray Street in Flushing.
Right.
The Parsons Nurseries, which are probably the biggest and most famous of all, that's Parsons Boulevard, one block east of Bound Street. And so those names are memorialized on the streets.
So what brought kind of the decline of horticulture as Flushing's industry?
By the end of the 19th century, we're in the industrial age, and already Flushing Creek was being... We had the railroads coming into Flushing. By as early as the 1850s, a railroad was built from Whitestone and College Point through Flushing all the way to Long Island City, connecting Manhattan to Westchester with ferries on either end. There was a ferry that went over the East River in Long Island City to Manhattan, and a ferry that went from Whitestone Landing to Westchester, which actually now the Bronx, that was part of Westchester then. So it connected those two pieces of New York State geography, and it was very successful, that railroad, for a number of years. And all along that railroad, industrial opportunities emerged, because you had the possibility of trains bringing big loads of things that you might be needed in the industries. And you can see that still in the asphalt plants that hug Flushing Creek. All along that the tracks have been ripped up in the part that goes to Whitestone. But if you know that North Flushing, that industrial area along Prince Street and Farrington Place, and it's all industrial. That's a descendant of the industries that used to line up along that railroad. Hmm. And so, also in College Point, and also at Whitestone Landing, because industries tried to align themselves with the railroads and also the waterways, because they needed the transportation.
So it was mostly a shipping kind of railroad, not exactly a passenger railroad.
Oh, correct. But they had passengers too.
Okay.
And you could actually, and that's the other thing that started happening, is with that passenger railroad from Flushing, you had a significant upper middle class resident group of Flushing who lived here on the plateau, here at Bound Street and Parsons Boulevard and up to Sanford Avenue, where the high good land was. And they had these big houses, and many of them worked in the financial trade in Manhattan, had significant jobs in Manhattan, and they were able to take a train here to Long Island City in about 20 minutes, and then take a ferry from Long Island City to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And the whole trip would be less than an hour. So whereas other people were living in brownstones or townhouses in Manhattan, in various favorable parts of Brooklyn and Queens, people lived in Victorian houses with private gardens and whatever in less urban surroundings, like they were the suburbs, and mm-hmm. they commuted into Manhattan. But as Flushing got a subway and Flushing got better railroad service after Penn Station opened in 1913, and they built a rail tunnel into Penn Station that cut the trip from Flushing to about 18 minutes, there was pressure to urbanize Flushing.
So can you talk a bit about how Flushing developed from that kind of community to what it is today? In the context of, you know, all the other things that are happening in New York.
Certainly. After World War II, two important demographic transitions took place, along with changes in our society and changes in the city. One was the development of Flushing into a very urban place from a suburban place, because in the late 19th century, with the railroad, Flushing became home to many upper-middle-class people who had large Victorian homes. When the subway came in 1927, Flushing was ripe for urbanization, but 2 years later came the stock market crash and the Depression, so it really didn't happen then. A couple of buildings were built, like the one across the street here. That's a late 20s building, but there are very few of those. Most of the buildings that you see around here in what were the better neighborhoods of Flushing that had the large private homes were built in the late 40s and 50s and early 60s. And they attracted people mostly of European ancestry who were coming from the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Manhattan, from neighborhoods that were changing demographically and often, you know, into black or Hispanic neighborhoods that people were a little leery about. Crime rates were going up. But also there was the attraction of living, they call this the country, believe it or not, and living here in a more modern apartment, particularly apartments that had garages in their basement so they could, you know, participate in the car revolution, because the whole economy of the United States was becoming so car-oriented. And the suburbs were growing up, and Flushing is now becoming, going from suburban to urban, but the suburbs out on Long Island are growing, and they're growing with shopping malls that are accessible by the Long Island Expressway. The parkways are already here. So there's this whole transition, and all the old urban centers are giving way to the suburban shopping malls. And people who lived in Flushing and Eastern Queens, you would drive out to the shopping malls, and that started hurting business in Flushing. They always call for more and more parking, but what Flushing really lacked were the modern malls, which you could stay indoors in any weather and had a greater variety of shops that many people would want. And Flushing's economy and commerce started going downhill and probably reached its nadir. It was at worst in the middle of the 70s. But by that time, the immigration laws had changed, and new immigrants were coming in, and unbeknownst to many people, were already buying land at bargain prices. Now, why did the immigrants come to Flushing, and which immigrants came to Flushing? This is the second demographic, great demographic change. In 1965, there's a coincidence. Two things happened in 1965 that make for this change. 1965 is the second year of the Second World's Fair. The Second World's Fair took place in 64-65, both years, with not only during the warmer weather months. And it was not a legitimate World's Fair. By legitimate, I mean Flushing, New York was not supposed to have a World's Fair. There's a whole committee that decides when and where World's Fairs can be. But Robert Moses wanted a World's Fair, so we had a World's Fair to attract business and also as a incentive to do a lot of the planning things that he wanted to do, like the Van Wyck Parkway extension, the Van Wyck Expressway extension, and a whole bunch of other things that were done about the same time, the Whitestone Expressway, whatever. That was in conjunction with the second fair. So we had a fair, but it wasn't really a World's Fair. The people from communist countries, socialist countries, and neutral countries, for the most part, did not attend. It was mostly our political allies in Asia, particularly Taiwan and South Korea, which were already rapidly industrializing countries and were already making inroads into the garment industry, which New York was losing, and also our NATO allies in Europe, and our friends in South America, which was always a kind of a protectorate of the United States. Mm-hmm. So those are the people that had the exhibits at the fair. And the Taiwanese and the South Koreans had particularly large exhibits at the fair. They slept over during the intervening years, mm-hmm. between 1964 and 1965. And where did they sleep? For the most part, in Flushing, because that's the closest place. And there were, you know, nice middle-class available apartments for them, because Flushing was already losing its European base, because those people were dying or retiring to Florida, and younger people were leaving New York or were more Manhattan-centric and, you know, weren't moving to apartments in Queens.
Right.
So this set up a whole bunch of vacancies here. Meanwhile, what else happens in 1965? Our immigration laws are reformed. And instead of being immigration being restricted to quotas of European immigrants that really weren't using them,
right,
they were made fairer across boundaries of internationally, and were made to attract people who had needed skills like teachers and engineers and people in the medical professions or people who brought money into the economy. And this attracted mostly people who were middle class in their countries of origin. And maybe they would be lower middle class here, but they spoke, for the most part, spoke English and had professions that we needed or brought money. And, you know, some of the early immigrants from Taiwan and the early immigrants from South Korea were of that class. Now that once they established, one of the other provisions of the law was that they could, family members and people who knew these people could be vouched for could also come. And these were often poor and maybe their English wasn't as good, but the law provided for that provision too. So that paved the way for an immigration that the beachhead was in Flushing for the Taiwanese and the South Koreans. A number of them established themselves. Eventually, they brought others because they were here. And when the population became large enough, say by the mid-70s for the Chinese and about 1980 for the Koreans, you have a large enough population to start opening grocery stores and maybe small newspapers and restaurants that cater mostly to that group. The more you do that, the more you have an infrastructure that attracts even more immigrants. Right. So the whole thing ballooned. So by the late 80s and 90s, these were booming Asian communities and very entrepreneurial, and they've grown and grown and grown ever since. And so now, you know, the population of Central Flushing is, you know, 75 or 80% Asian, and the whole commercial structure has changed, and it's expanded. The Chinese business community particularly petitioned city planning to get the whole industrial zone of Flushing from Prince Street down to the river changed so that they could build new condos and commercial facilities there, and that's happened. So that couldn't happen in Chinatown. China was hemmed in. So for the most part, Flushing and other parts of the city became a place where Chinese who were better off could move to and expand their commerce. Mm-hmm. Korea, and for the Koreans, Flushing was the center of activity, and the Koreans, Chinese kind of centralized in Flushing and moved things between Main Street and the river, whereas the Koreans kind of, their beachhead was on Union Street, and then they moved out Northern Boulevard into Car Country.
So that's why the first Asian residents of Flushing were overwhelmingly from Taiwan and South Korea, because they happened to be left over from the World's Fair.
Yeah, it's typically the way migration of an ethnic group works is the first immigrants settle somewhere, and it's almost by accident. And here that accident is that, and often we don't even know what it is. And the only way you can find that is if you can catch it early and find out who. And a platform of mine as Queensborough historian is to trace the origin of many of the immigrant communities here in Queens, mm-hmm. not just the ones in Flushing. While the first and second generation is still around.
Right.
And we can find out who came first and how do they establish themselves. Sometimes it's a church, and the church attracts more people. There's a lot of ways, but basically it's some people landing in a certain place by accident, although there were plenty of middle-class apartments available all along the number 7 train, because all those European ethnics were moving out. And so this is a middle-class neighborhood. They were middle-class people coming in, or certainly with middle-class pretensions, and they weren't going to be moving to the South Bronx or to Harlem,
right,
or to North Brooklyn, into the poorer neighborhoods. They were going to be moving into places that the Europeans were leaving.
Now, as someone who's been here for quite a while and seen how things have changed, do you see kind of an arc to Flushing's development? And is there something you would like to see Flushing become in the future?
I'd like to see a greater variety of people. I think in the last few years, you're beginning to see more young Caucasians coming in here. That's just rent pressure.
That's just rent
pressure. It's still relatively cheap to live here.
Well,
and I think I've seen more, you know, some, you know, round-eyed people here, blonde people who haven't dyed their hair. I've seen a slight uptick in that.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to see this neighborhood become more ethnically diverse, as it was, say, in the early 80s. It was very ethnically diverse. I mean, age different, you know, the Asians were younger, of course, than the Europeans that were here, but I liked that community a little bit better here. I feel like a minority here myself. Sometimes I don't even notice it. I just see people. But sometimes I feel like a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I like that. I'd like to feel that this was a more mixed community. I wish it was more like Jackson Heights, which has a greater variety of people.
Okay. So can you talk a bit about how about the tours you're doing, about the classes that
are we
you're
still
teaching?
Being recorded?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't see anything up there.
No, it's yeah.
Okay. So beginning in 1980, when I've been back in there for 4 years in this apartment for 2 years, I always used to teaching geography. I always did field work with my students. So I decided to try to lead walking tours in New York.
Okay.
But I do about 30 or 40 walking tours a year now. Some of them sponsored by myself, some of them sponsored by the internet, some of them custom tours for college classes and other groups.
Okay. And is
and I enjoy it very much. It's probably the most fun I have.
And is there a place where we can find more information about
Absolutely. That? Absolutely. You can look at my website.
Okay.
And it's simple to get to. It's www.geognyc, that's G-E-O-G, like geography, NYC, like New York City, .com.
Okay.
geognyc.com. And it describes how I got into this and has a catalog of most of the tours that I've done and will do. And obviously I can do something for you that's different from that, too.
Okay. And that about does it for this episode. Thank you, Jack, and thank you for listening.